Live from Everbank Field, 1010 XL 92.5 FM presents Jaguars Today with your host Mike Dempsey and Jeff Lagerman.
Hey, glad you're along, everybody. Wild West Guns and Gold brings you Jaguars Today every Monday. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony, Jeff Lagerman.
That's
Tony,
a good fit, by
back
the way.
To the Super Bowl. What is Wild West Guns and Gold?
Yeah, me on Monday.
You should have been coming in on Mondays all season long because Ozier was really enjoying Wild West. Because he got hung up on the fact that you can trade your gold for guns at Wild West Guns and Gold. And I don't think he understands that a lot of people think gold is a good investment. It's something to hang on to. It always retains its value.
I think the other's a good investment.
Guns as well, right? So they're equally popular with our friends at Wild West. We are back. Tony, I got to ask you a question. Did the Seattle bag of Skittles make it back to Jacksonville?
Yeah, it's in my backpack.
It is. Excellent. Because we had two for you for the swag bag.
Yeah. Okay.
They have a special, like, Seattle edition because, you know, Marshawn Lynch with the Skittle
sure.
thing. And Jackie Slater sat down. We had him on the table. Jackie
He's a great
Slater.
Guy.
He is a great guy. I have this? And who are we to say no?
I actually sat next to Jackie Slater for about 3 or 4 years when I was a union rep. And Jackie was a union rep. Me and Jackie used to sit together the years in which we were on that union representation board
right.
for those years. And a wise man, well-spoken, extremely intelligent. In fact, me and Jackie worked together to actually get the retired players' insurance policies extended a number of years post-retirement. And it was great to have him as an ally because when Jackie spoke, people listened.
And, you know, it's funny talking to him, Jeff. He says he's just got the most amazing genetics. Doesn't have any aches and pains.
It's crazy because I remember sitting next to the table with Jackie for those years, and I don't remember at what point we had this conversation, but, you know, I had, you know, 9 surgical procedures in 10 years, and here's a guy sitting next to me. I don't even think he had one, you know.
He played 20 years. He told us, you know, he goes, I always wondered when guys play 15 years, why didn't they play the 16th? And I'm thinking, Jackie, you played 20. Why didn't you play 21? At some point, people's bodies give out. Normal human beings do.
There are some guys that genetically just have it. I mean, Jackie Slater, the Matthews brothers, you know, obviously Clay and Bruce, and hopefully their sons will be able to have that same genetic trait because they're great players and fun to watch. But Jackie Slater, one of the all-time great guys, and it's great to call him a friend, and I really enjoyed my time that I spent with him.
Oh, you know, one of the most interesting guys I met this week was Will Shields. You know Will at all?
Mm-hmm.
He got elected to the Hall of Fame. I was surprised Orlando Pace didn't get in, to be quite honest with you. But Will Shields, very deserving, 12 Pro Bowls in 14 seasons. Guy was a dominant player. It's tough, you know, I guess, for interior linemen to get a lot of recognition, but he did everything he could. And he's been doing so many things for so long. He's had a foundation for about 20 years that's been helping abused women. And, you know, all this talk that went into this last year with the Ray Rice incident, you'd think that most people in the NFL just realized it's an issue in this last 12 months. And that goes to show you that obviously some people have been forward thinking or at least recognize the problem. But he owns 2 banks. He started his own banks. He is really an interesting guy. I'd never met him before. He was one of the cooler guys I met this week.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to know Will all that well, but just watching him from afar about how he conducted himself, you always appreciated that. But you want to talk about a great football player? I mean, a great football player. And Kansas City had some good offensive lines. And so when you have a great offensive line, sometimes it's hard to have one guy stand out. Will stood out.
Yeah, he absolutely, and I mean, the 12 Pro Bowl honors certainly back that up. We'll talk a little bit about the week, but really want to tap into your expertise one last time. This is the last hurrah, at least for a while, you know, in the offseason. I'm sure you'll pop in from time to time, but we'll break down Super Bowl 49 and what you saw yesterday on the field. Where were the mistakes made? I thought, for the most part, very well-played game. You know, certainly some mistakes were made along the way. Tom Brady's first interception was inexplicable.
That was terrible.
Inexplicable in that circumstance. Gets some points on the board.
Well, he made that. I mean, he had a guy bearing down on him, and I can't remember if it was Averill or Bennett.
I think it was Bennett.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you talk about a terrible reaction. I mean, literally, it was chuck and duck.
Lollipop up for grabs, over the middle of the field.
Terrible.
Yeah.
And you don't expect that out of a guy like Tom Brady of his stature. And for him to make that mistake early in the ballgame, I just sat back and I was going, Tom Brady, really? You just made that throw? I mean, That was, I hate to say this, but that was Peyton Manning-esque in the playoffs.
It really, really was. And I was thinking the same thing in that first half is going along, and I'm like, wow. You know, and then the Patriots ultimately got out to the lead, but Seattle came storming back, and I'm like, boy, if they lose this, and Brady's had a couple of critical errors.
Yeah, well, the second interception wasn't that bad. I mean, that
wasn't,
it wasn't a great read, but you could understand why it happened because it was a difficult read to see that guy coming.
He never saw him coming at
all. No, he didn't, and so it's kind of hard to, I mean, look, when you're a quarterback and you throw it, what, 50-something times in a ball game, I mean, something like that's going to happen. But the first one was inexcusable.
Bottom line, he threw four touchdowns, won MVP, and now he's got four Super Bowl titles. So it's easy to nitpick that kind of stuff. He doesn't care, you know, if he had thrown 10 touchdowns as long as the end result was the same in that. Obviously, we'll talk about the decision by Pete Carroll and Daryl Bevel and the offensive coaching staff of Seattle to go for a passing play on second and one with about 20 seconds left that resulted in an interception that effectively ended the game, or at least effectively set up the end of the game when Seattle then jumped off sides. Michael Bennett's
But it doesn't matter. I mean, at that point,
you're sitting there at the 2-inch line, right? You stuff him in the end zone. You get
a
safety.
Not quite the 2-inch line.
It was pretty. It was already inside the one, and they had half the distance penalty on the celebration. That thing is sitting there.
Could it have happened if they got a safety? Yes.
It could have.
Was it likely?
No,
probably
it wasn't likely,
not.
But that was your last chance to win
like
the game.
Just like the Green Bay. That, there's no question it was last chance to win the ball game. And but you understand that everybody's trying to get a jump on that. And Bennett obviously has had issues with offside.
Led the league.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was disappointing. But at the end, I mean, it would have taken a perfect storm of events for Seattle to end up coming back.
Could you have
situation.
Imagined? No, imagine if they stuffed Brady, get the safety, and I mean, the last 15 seconds of this game, 2-point game. We already saw Russell Wilson lead the quickest touchdown drive that you'll ever see at the end of a half to go to the length of the field.
But they would have gotten the 2 points, and then New England would have been able to punt or kick off
right.
after the safety.
So they would have had maybe 12 seconds left,
maybe,
and been up or down by two,
needing
so
a field goal.
You're trying to get into a 57-yard field
Could
goal.
Could have happened, yes.
At least it would have been interesting. No,
I'm all for it. You know, I wanted it to happen. I'm with you.
I
was rooting for Seattle because, you know, look, Pete Carroll's my coach for 5 years in New York, 4 years as a coordinator, 1 year as a head coach. And I love Pete. I love how he goes about his business. He is the complete opposite of a Bill Belichick. Not that I dislike a Bill Belichick because I played for a guy that's like Bill Belichick and Tom Coughlin. But I'm rooting for Pete because I know Pete. And so I want, even though I had really a rooting interest, I wanted a good football game.
We got it.
And it was a really good football game to me. Kind of a little bit slow there for a little while when it was punt, 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 back and forth for a while. But I wanted to see that at the end of the ball game get interesting with the safety.
It would have been nice. As it was, one of the better down-to-the-wire Super Bowls you're ever going to see.
That's great.
You want to get in today, 641-1010 is the way to do it. We haven't taken a phone call, and it feels like a month, but it's really probably been about a week and a half, and you're welcome to weigh in today. Your thoughts on any aspect of Super Bowl 49, welcome to bring those to the table today, including the decision to pass, not run. I'm sure that will be not universally, but heavily panned, I would think, by most audiences today. We'll also get Jeff's reaction to some of the coaching hires for the Jaguars staff. While we were gone, I'm sure you shared those on Jaguars Thursday last week, but we'll share those with the Jaguars Today audience coming up today as well. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony, Jeff Logman here with you on a Wild West Guns and Gold Monday on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
No, I told him. I said, throw it. Yeah, I mean, because of the matchup. I said, let's not run through goal line, throw it. And then because we still have third and fourth down to win it. And that was where, you know, we would use the timeout. And if you get an incomplete, the clock stops and you have a timeout left and you have your opportunity to run it on third down. Use your timeout, then you can do whatever you want on fourth down.
Pete Carroll trying to explain the decision-making in the final half minute of the football game yesterday. I didn't think he did himself a service with the way he explained it. He almost made it sound like, well, if we ran it, we were wasting a play. But at one point he also said, well, we'll waste this one and we'll run it on third down. He just felt like that play was a throwaway play almost.
Yeah, he said, we can waste the play throwing it here. Well, you're in the Super Bowl, bud. You got to score a touchdown to win a second championship in a row. You're talking about being willing to waste a down?
See, he said at one point that they put three wide receiver personnel out there, mm-hmm. and New England went with their goal line stack, you know, big personnel. According to Carroll,
if you actually look at it, they still had four down. They had basically their base personnel, so they kept their base personnel on the field. It's not really goal line personnel. They kept their base personnel. In which, in the middle of the field, you probably would have matched up with your nickel personnel, if I'm getting that right, and I think I am right, that they were in base personnel versus nickel. So it's not really a goal line look, but it's a bigger personnel typically than what you would see.
He made it sound, well, he didn't make it sound, he said he saw their goal line personnel. That's what he claimed, okay? I'm not arguing for one side or the other here. And it gave me the impression that they went up there and they were going to see what personnel New England was in. And if they were in, I don't know. I mean, you say they're already in their base stuff anyway, but if they were in something that was more amenable to not stacking up the box, that they might have run the ball there. Because that to me is what he made it sound like. And again, it comes down to kind of indecision. Just do what you're going to do. If you want to throw it, I don't have a problem with throwing it on second down. I do not like the route because even if it doesn't get jumped to that degree, if it pops off his shoulder blade or shoulder pad straight up in the air, then, you know, the same result can come about.
Yeah, so what you're saying is you'd like to see a fade to that number 13, the guy everybody's
Chris
going,
Matthews.
Who's
Matthews,
that guy?
Yeah. Right, who was dominating his guy pretty much all night, you know?
Until they switched to Browner. And there's actually been stories about that already today. Browner went to the sideline at halftime, and he's like, let me have the big guy. I don't know who that guy is, but let me have the big guy. And Chris Matthews really wasn't a factor in the second half of that game. I also heard Darrelle Revis after the game. He went on the set with ESPN, and they asked him, you know, what were y'all in on that last play? And he was like, we weren't really in goal line. We saw they had three wide receivers. He said that he was getting ready to run off the field, assuming they were just going to pound Marshawn Lynch. Right. And when they saw that they had three wide receivers on the field, we were like, it's kind of our goal line with three corners. So it was still Revis and Browner and their third corner on the field there that wound up making the play, but they were like, we kind of half expected throw once we saw they had three wide receivers in the game in that spot.
I said last week, I said when the matchup was set, that I was rooting for both of them to lose if at all possible, and you know, I don't like either one of them particularly.
That's about as close as you could get.
To be honest with you, I mean, the more that game played out with Seattle, Doug Baldwin, I mean, really? You catch a touchdown of Darrelle Revis. He says that the celebration wasn't directed at him. He mimes pulling his pants out. We've seen Randy Moss mime mooning the crowd before, okay? Yeah. At which he said that Packer fans used to do to the Minnesota bus, and that's why he was kind of returning the favor. Here, Doug Baldwin then cops a squat and drops the football like he's dropping something else, okay? And they, you know, you knew something was up because you could see him do it in real time on TV, like pulling the pants down. And then Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth would never tell you exactly why. But then, of course, you know, it's all over the internet immediately, what he did. That just, Jeff, the arrogance out of these guys last week. And you have every right. You can act any way you like. You don't have to act to make me happy. But I'm going to react to your demeanor as well, and the arrogance of these guys at media day last week was so overwhelming that there's part of me that says serves you right, you know, and that's just the way I'm. Of course,
well, you're not the only one who feels that way. I mean, there are some people around the league that felt like the Seattle over since last year has really gained an arrogance about them, players, coaches, etc. And so there were some that were rooting against the Seattle Seahawks because of that arrogance. But, hey, look, confidence, arrogance, what do you want to call it? I don't know. But if you're a coach or if you're a fan, you become some, and you're a fan of that team, you're like, okay, hey, look, whatever it takes to get them motivated,
right,
whatever gets their juices going, I'm okay with.
And I get that. But then to me, when you, in the last 10 seconds of the game, after you jump off sides and the game's over with, now you're acting like petulant little baby.
Well,
right?
Mike, I'm okay with that. Look, I mean, you're in the Super Bowl and you had the ball at the 1 yard line and you were expecting to win that ball game. And, emotions run high. I mean, that's just part of the deal. And so to have a little altercation at the end, I didn't like it, but I also understand it. And Martellus Bennett, I thought, was over the top. I thought Bruce Irvin was out of control. I think Gronkowski was egging it on a little bit, but I also get that too. You know, you're winning. You're winning the Super Bowl. You know, so I don't concentrate much on that play.
All right. Rubbed me the wrong way.
I mean, when you think about it, I mean, you've worked the entire year from last year's Super Bowl to get to this moment. And it just got taken away from you.
To me, it's like a little kid who throws a fit when they get their favorite toy taken away. That's what it was like.
It's not a toy.
Well, I understand that. But whatever the case, that you teach your kids, you got to deal with that. That's not how you deal with life. And I get that. Look, you fight hard. It's a well-played game. The Patriots didn't do anything cheap to make that interception. You jumped off sides. You want to get mad? Get mad at Michael Bennett for jumping off sides and taking away your last shred of a chance to win the game. I just thought it was a little I enjoyed seeing some
like
of those guys
either.
Get their comeuppance.
I didn't like it either, but I understand the moment and what those guys are going through because they thought they had it.
All right, let's get on the phone line, 641-1010. Tyler, we can hear your mic in our ear, by the way.
It's pretty annoying.
Thank you. Please. Let's go with Steve with a question about Seattle's defense. Steve, how are you this morning?
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you?
Steve, good morning.
Justin,
Tyler, do we not have Steve?
No, Steve's there.
On it. You know,
is he on the air? Because we don't hear him.
We need. What's that?
Go ahead, Steve. This is the first time we're hearing you. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. We need, what is it? You know, you talked about reputation of Seattle defense. Dan and Jeff talked about it this morning. But haven't you also, both of y'all have talked about, we need arrogance. We need a little of the bad boy attitude. We need somebody with that kind of persona.
I don't need somebody dropping their pants and faking dropping a football. Well, that's an example. I don't need, when the game is over, when your quarterback gets knocked down, I want an offensive lineman to get in somebody's face, okay? But when the game is over and it's been a well-played game and the better team has won or they've won on this given day, don't act like little babies and spoil brat. That to me is what it was. And I get it. There is a level of arrogance. You want your quarterback to have a little cockiness to him. You want your players to have a little cockiness to them. I do. I get that. And maybe for me, my comfort level with it is different than other people's.
Honestly, I want Sherman. I don't want Baldwin. I think Sherman is a really confident guy that a lot of people see that coming off as arrogance. And I think that he's willing to have a little bit of fun on the sideline when Darrell Revis gets thrown on for a touchdown that he's looking at.
You don't think Richard Sherman is arrogant?
I think it's more confidence than it is arrogance because after the game, who's the first guy shaking Tom Brady's hand after they win the Super Bowl? Richard freaking Sherman. I think he gets it. I think that he understands there's a lot of guys on that team that feed off the way that he plays the game emotionally, but I think that's because he's very confident in what he can do. I think a lot of people misinterpret a lot of what Richard Sherman does as arrogance. I want that guy on my team 150% of the time because I think guys do feed off that. I think Baldwin is a clown for the stuff that he was doing on the field. But I think people on that team love what Richard Sherman brings
to them. Yeah, there's a big difference there. I mean,
Richard Sherman's really good.
I mean,
that's the big
you're talking
difference.
A really good football player who is confident, and Baldwin is a dip, in the other word that would combine with that, is fit. So just leave it at that.
Dip spit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got a cup of it over there anywhere handy? Sometimes you do. 641-1010. Let's go back to the line. Mike, you're next up on Jaguars Today. Good morning. How are you?
We just talked to Mike.
No, we thought we were talking to Steve. Is Steve on the line, Tyler?
Good morning, guys. This is Mike. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
This is why football is the greatest game in the world. It's the emotion of that last 2 minutes if you're a Seattle fan. And a New England fan was unbelievable. It was just a great football game. And obviously I'm a New England fan, so I'm thrilled. But I'm 60 years old. I was watching with my kids. It's the greatest game the kids will ever see in the next 40 years. And well, I called that play. I text my brothers and I called that play. I call that play the immaculate interception. It was an unbelievable interception. The greatest ever.
Well, and that's the play that, I mean, will go down in Super Bowl history.
Sure.
I mean, that's
the game
the play. I mean, that's the play that everybody will remember. You know, and I'm sure, look, there may be greater games to come up, but I mean, that was clearly one of them. edge of the seat at the end of the game. Super Bowls sometimes have a tendency, and I always call the magnification of mistakes in playoff time, which have a tendency sometimes to have games get out of control. And for this Super Bowl to remain competitive and come down to the wire, I think is a great testament to both organizations, Pete Carroll and Bill Belichick. And it was fun to watch. And I think the reason why that this is one of the greatest or highest rated games in Super Bowl history, which the numbers came out, and it is now the highest rated game since the one 2 years ago, was this game had such a non-diehard football buildup leading up to this game with Deflategate, to where even casual football fans and non-football fans took an interest in this game because of the whole Deflategate. And the NFL, you know, probably felt somewhat of embarrassment over this whole issue being talked about. But that was the greatest PR lead-up to a Super Bowl that you could ever ask for. I mean, because it made everybody have an opinion, and then it made people want to watch the game. And,
and you already had two evenly matched teams, and it played out that way.
Well, I mean, but really, to get the record-setting numbers, you need the casual fans that may not normally watch, want to watch, something to draw them in. And I think that the Deflategate, because it became a conversation on every news channel throughout the country, helped push that. So kudos to the NFL for allowing that to just simmer.
Sure.
Two weeks leading
you know
up
what
to
else?
The game.
Just Marshawn Lynch's act or non-act.
Well, and we spent, you know, a week in Arizona driving around with a bunch of people that weren't necessarily football fans, but every one of them would make some wisecrack about, hey, check the footballs. I mean, everybody was aware of that story.
The, what do you call them anymore? The, they're not stewardesses. The, who's the
airline attendants?
The airline attendant, the guy from South Africa.
Right.
Right? Was, he thought he was the first guy to make a joke about a deflated football. This is Saturday before the game. It's like, bro, we've heard him for 2 weeks now. All right, calm down.
Yeah, I got on Twitter during the first quarter last night, and then I quickly got off because I was like, I can't take this. I can't take everybody making a crack about the football right now. I'll come back a little bit later when everyone's kind of gotten it out of their system a little bit. And then after the game, everyone making the jokes about Marshawn Lynch was only there not to get fined. I had to step away for about 5 minutes again. I was like, come on, we're better than this. We can be better than this, sports fans, and
no,
then I came back to it.
No, we can't. It's that's right there on the pulse of American fandom right there, Tony. I think it's pretty accurate reflection of it, actually. 641-1010 if you'd like to get on board. Your comments about Super Bowl 49 and where things are headed. Maybe later in the week we'll talk about who will be the early favorites. We know in the betting circles, I mean, Vegas has already got these same two teams at the top of the board for 2015. Obviously, a lot's going to depend on Denver, whether or not Peyton Manning comes back or not, and certainly several others right there in the mix. All right, 641-1010. It's a phone number. It's a Wild West Guns and Gold Money. By the way, fan feedback spotlight today. I think it's a legit question. Six Super Bowl appearances, four championships, and consistently in the postseason with 10-plus win seasons. Is the Belichick-Brady-Patriots teams the greatest dynasty in NFL history? And I do believe this is, to me, one era of Patriots football, because the head coach and the quarterback define it, and all the other pieces for the most part have been interchangeable. Some great pieces around them at times, certainly, but a lot of different pieces over the years, but the quarterback and head coach remain the same. That's brought to you by the Tom Bush family of dealerships. Weigh in on the fan feedback spotlight by tweeting at MD_1010XL, at 1010XL Fat Tony, at Logs56 LOGS56, or on the Jaguars Today Facebook page. Back with more Jaguars Today in a moment on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Russell in the pocket. Russell for Curse, and it's broken up again. And is it? But somehow, oh, and he winds up with a football.
I think Butler hit it, and it fell right back down to the ground. Unbelievable. That's exactly what happened, isn't it?
Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth on the call when it looked like maybe the Patriots were going to succumb to another famous, ridiculous catch Same site, same
venue. Oh, the look on Brady's face was priceless.
It really was. You know, I don't put the Mario Manningham catch in that. Everyone's like, oh, the Mario Manningham catch. Giants were winning the game at that point anyway, and there's no guarantee the Patriots win the game if he doesn't make that catch. They pretty much win the Super Bowl if David Tyree doesn't come up with that catch. And this one, who knows? You know, there's still a lot of time left. If they don't complete the one to Curse, maybe they go down the field a little bit more conventionally, you know, 10, 15 yards.
Yeah, that was first down.
Right.
You were looking at second and 10 with a minute 20 left in that game. So they were still in position to potentially get down there and give themselves a chance.
But still.
Then they lost their minds. Like, it's like they didn't expect to get 4.5 yards on first down. Whatever their plan was to throw on second down when we got 2 yards on first, maybe that was the idea. Then they got the 4.5 yards, and it's like everybody on Seattle just forgot where they were or what they were doing.
The thing that shocked me, Jeff, was Al Michael and Chris Collinsworth totally not understanding the situation. Patriots are up 4, and they're suggesting they let Seattle score a touchdown intentionally. Now, if you're down 1, I get it. Let the other team score. Now you're down 8. You get the ball back. It's still a one-possession game, right? Mm-hmm. Even if you are down or if you're up by, let's say, 1 or 2 points and a field goal is going to beat you, and all they have to do is basically kneel it out, and kick what amounts to an extra point, I get that scenario.
Yeah.
You're up 4. Just hold them out of the end zone. You're going to win the football game. This is a completely different scenario. And for those guys to suggest that that was the right move at that time, I thought was
I didn't know where that was coming from.
Yeah.
But I have attested a lot of times. I mean, I caught a little bit of that. But when I watch a football game, a lot of times I'm not paying attention to what they're saying
right
at a critical moment because I'm so focused in on what's the personnel, what's the formation. You know, I'm so glued into watching the actual play that I don't hear anything. It's almost like the blinders close my ears shut when it comes to announcers in the game.
Wild West Guns and Gold Monday here on Jaguars Today. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony, Jeff Loggeman here with you. Loggy in for his final regularly scheduled appearance for a while. And then I'm sure we'll pop in with you, or you'll pop in with us, hopefully, throughout the course of the offseason from time to time. Let's go to the phone line, 641-1010. Marcus is up next on Jaguars Today. Good morning, Marcus.
Hey, good morning.
What's up?
I was calling. I enjoyed the game last night, especially the ending. Don't like the Patriots, but I cannot stand the Seahawks. They are, I agree with you, arrogant pricks. I think they're schoolhouse bullies. And it starts that the coaching goes down. And that last play, where they threw the pick didn't surprise me at all. That formation, they run it a lot. And it was evident because they were going to throw the ball because he's just arrogant.
All right. Hey, appreciate the call. I don't know if they threw it out of arrogance, but I think it goes back to what you said. They do run that play out of that formation. And the fact that you've got this undrafted kid that's played about 200 snaps all season long, knew in at least what he said immediately afterward. And he seems sincere.
Totally prepared.
I felt it was a pick play. And rather than sit there and think, am I right or am I wrong? I just had to trust what I saw and was prepared for. Like you said, boy, did he jump that aggressively, Jeff, because he went right through the back of Lockett. But if you're making a play on the ball, they're not going to call any kind
of
interference.
No, that's not a penalty.
That. Right.
I mean, he's making a play.
He was
on
going
the ball.
Directly at the football. He has every right to catch that football as well. And it wasn't could Ricardo Lockett have got a little more aggressively? I don't know if you were stopping the freight train that was coming. That was
Lockett's expecting, and I can't remember who the inside wide receiver was. Maybe it was Baldwin to actually drive up the field against Brandon Browner to create a little bit of a pick. You know, it's kind of a stack,
right?
But they're not truly stacked. They're spaced out a little bit, but one guy's behind the ball because he wants to run underneath. And Brandon Browner did a tremendous job of jamming at the line of scrimmage to allow that straight line approach to make that play. And like I said before, an undrafted rookie free agent that has the awareness, because when you watch him, as soon as the wide receiver plants a foot, he's breaking. And he's breaking 100 miles an hour. If that wide receiver turns, Lockett goes outside, I mean, he would have been all alone for nothing, but I mean, to be able to be prepared for that play and to be aware of that look, knowing that here it comes, and then to wait to see the confirmation of it, and then to break on the ball like that, I mean, to me, that's just a great job of coaching.
And a little bit to me, I mean, that was not a deadly accurate pass. In that scenario, you got to put it right on your guy. I thought it was a little too far out
in
front.
I don't think it was too far out in front so much as it was is that Russell Wilson was expecting Lockett to break hard and clean. And Lockett, in reality, if he's going to, Darrell Bevell kind of, I guess, put out there at the end of the game that Lockett could have made a little bit stronger play at the ball. First of all, you don't say that as a coach. You just suck it up and take your lumps and move on. And so now you have a situation where the coaches blame the player and some of the Seahawks players are criticizing the play call. That's not a healthy situation. But Lockett, in reality, should have driven to the inside and, much like a basketball player, used his body to put his body between the defender and the ball and said that the only person that could make a play on the ball was him, to where the defender would have to drive through his entire body,
right,
not just his arms. So, but it didn't happen.
Richard, you're up next here on Jaguars Today. Good morning.
I've got a totally different take that has not been discussed anymore, I think, and that is that as far as I was concerned, the first half, the officiating was terrible, and it looked like payback for Deflategate.
I didn't see that at all. I mean, a couple of missed calls, but I thought there were some calls that could have gone either way. I didn't get the sense that
payback for Deflategate.
Yeah,
how
so? I didn't see that. I saw both secondaries were allowed to be really aggressive for
it's
the entire
playoff
game.
Football, yeah. They let them play, and that's what they do. And that's what they should do.
Look, the running into the kicker should have been roughing the kicker. Okay, and by rule, if you hit the guy's plant leg, it's supposed to be roughing the kicker. But you know, I didn't think the referee's got a lot more to worry about. They didn't, even if they purposely deflated the footballs, they weren't trying to stick it to the refs. They were trying to stick it to the Colts, right? And they weren't trying to show up the referees. I don't get the sense that people are blaming the referees in this, the Deflategate scenario, if in fact they tested the balls before the game, they were good, and then they tested them again at halftime and found them not to be good and removed them for play. I haven't heard anybody suggest that the referees were to blame for that scenario.
No, so. I thought the game was officiated very well. They made obvious calls, the ones that were very clear. They didn't jump into that, you know, borderline calls at all during the ball game. Bill Vinovich, I think, is the head official in that ball game, is one of the most respected officials. He's very consistent. He referees a game without emotion. He doesn't try to be the show. I have great respect for him, and I have great respect for the NFL officials as a whole. I think they do a great job.
We had just 3 minutes ago, I mean, right before we took that call, Duval Doom tweets, let's give him credit, the game was perfectly officiated. Kudos to that crew. I don't know about perfectly, but
nothing's perfect.
Nothing that I felt like it was unfairly stacked one way or the other the whole game.
No. I didn't notice them, and honestly, I was just talking about it too. There were replays. They would show a play over again, and I was like, I've seen that called before, and I was glad that it wasn't. As a football fan, I was like, I'm glad there's no flag on that because it affects the game in a way. I don't want to see this kind of game affected.
Now, tell me this, how this happened, though, okay? On the Edelman play, where he catches the pass, and then he gets up and keeps running, right? And at first, before you've seen the replay, where you see his knee and his forearm go down, there's indecision on the refs. Nobody's called anything. And they're talking. Nobody's called for a replay on this, okay? And then right as they're getting ready to set the ball, Collinsworth or Al Michaels, one of them says, oh, one of the other refs just ran in and said, no. Where did he, what? That struck me as somebody getting something in their headphones saying, oh, guys, we took a look at this, and no, you can't blow this. They were down. It was such a delayed call. Nobody would say where the ball was spotted. And they said at the last second, this other referee came running in, if you go back and listen to it, and said, oh, no, he was down right here. If he had that view, why did he wait all that time? I swear to you, it seemed to me like he only made that call after all those replays got shown and it was definitively proven by replay, which they're not allowed to look at in terms of spotting that ball. They did get it right. It just struck me as a little coincidental, the timing on how that whole thing played out.
And when you got a play like that, where the last thing in the world that you want to do if you're an official is to blow the play dead, and then all of a sudden the play can't be allowed to continue on, it's easier to come back and say, well, the play was down here, and then correct it at that point. You can't go back and say, well, his knee wasn't down, so now
I understand all that. I think they executed it the right way, but it just seemed to me like that there was all this, nobody really knew, was he down, was he not down, and then very late after, once the replays started getting shown, the referee, like you said, they made the right call, and ultimately, so nobody, you know, got cheated on that whole scenario. Hard to imagine.
Are you saying that there was a little conspiracy going on with
that? I'm saying that, maybe they wanted to make sure the referees got that call right. I don't know, how that whole thing
works. And by the way, Edelman pretty clearly shoved the defensive back out of the way to get that last touchdown. But I, again, I was fine with that not being an offensive pass interference call.
I thought there was that kind of stuff was going on all night
exactly.
on both sides, and
yeah,
it wasn't getting called either way.
Right. I was fine with it not being called.
Don't call it different in the last 2 minutes.
Collinsworth was like, there's no pass interference here. I was like, well,
yeah, Collinsworth.
There is. He was, they're just
right.
not calling.
He said there was no contact there.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa.
Right.
Chris, I think there was contact.
Right.
There,
he kind of missed, he kind of redirected him a little bit, but they
redirected him. I think that would be a very light term.
All right. Well, whatever you want to call it. They've been doing it both ways pretty much all night.
Well, they ran that play not too long before that, in which Tom Brady missed Edelman. And but you know, I want to say this about Julian Edelman. I mean, Edelman was clearly hurt in that ball game. There was some discussion that did he have a concussion on a hit that he took from Cam Chancellor. I don't know that, and but I can tell you that Julian Edelman was clearly hurt. He had the hip injury a couple weeks ago against Indianapolis, and you could tell that he was not 100%, and he was extremely uncomfortable, but he fought through it, and he was Tom Brady's main guy, and what a tremendous performance that he had. Gutsy.
He had an outstanding performance. Amendola really had a big...
Yeah, and he had one short arm play that was not very pretty.
But for a guy who has not nearly been the focal point of that offense this year, I think they were trying to take away certain stuff, and they felt like both of those guys on the underneath stuff were going to be the key to the passing attack, and I think for the most part it was. And plus, you also got the one, I think it was the second big play to Chris Matthews. You had the first one, which I thought was thrown over the wrong shoulder, but he made a nice adjustment to it. Then you had the touchdown pass. But in the second half, when they hit the one up the left sideline, I think he shoved off to create separation on that one, too. Doesn't take much in that circumstance. So, again, they went both ways, and they called him, I felt, pretty consistently. This date in football history coming up, the Honda Drive around the NFL. More of your phone calls. Welcome, 641-1010 on a Wild West Guns and Gold Monday. Jaguars today on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
And now, this date in football history.
This date in football history presented by Dr. James McCall's Comprehensive and Cosmetic Dentistry. Some famous birthdays on this date going back to 1800.
Whoa.
And 95. Who do you think could be that impactful on the NFL, born in 1895?
I have no idea.
Papa Bear Hallis. George Hallis was a co-founder of the National Football League, Hall of Fame coach, owner, you name it, and player as well. George Hallis also played in Major League Baseball, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, for the Yankees back in the 1920s or something along those
lines. Pitchers and catchers in 2 weeks.
They're coming. This date in 1958, Dexter Manley was born. Dexter Manley, who became infamous for, after having made the National Football League out of Oklahoma State, it was discovered or admitted to that he read on a second grade level, was functionally illiterate. How do you get through college? How do you get through high school? How do you continue? I mean, what a failure on so many accounts to have that be possible, that could possibly occur, Jeff.
You
got to
be a really, really good athlete to make it through exactly what he did. I mean, that's crazy. Yeah,
because they're going to help you along, is
I guess,
your point,
yeah,
right?
But I mean, I just can't imagine why anybody would do that for a guy just because he's a good athlete.
He got held back,
help
they
the
said.
Guy out.
Right, he got held back in second grade, which is basically when his reading level stopped, and they put him in classes for what, at the time, they deemed mentally retarded people. I know that phrase is probably not acceptable in a lot of circles, but at that time, that's what it was. He... And I read the story this morning to kind of refresh my memory. Got pushed along the system, and he said by the time he hit around 10th grade, he said, I can't ask for help.
Look, I'm going to tell you a story now. That's not an isolated case. There was a guy when I was in New York, and I'll just use his nickname. His nickname was Kool-Aid. And we called him Kool-Aid because he had the biggest head known to man. I mean, he had to custom order a helmet for
him. Yeah.
And I'll never forget that, you know, prior to the games, we typically had to write a report, you know, of the guys that you were going to face, you know. So you had basically what they wanted you to do was study a lot of film during the week and then show that with a written report to your positional coach prior to the game. And Kool-Aid came to me the morning that it was due, and he said, hey, I need to talk to you. And I said, what's up? And he said, look, he said, I don't write so good. And I said, well, let me see what you got. And this was a guy, you know, that graduated high school, 4 years of college. And I looked at what he had, and it was nothing. I mean, the guy could not write. And I felt bad. You know, so I went to my positional coach and said, hey, look, Kool-Aid, he can't write. And he's like, what? Are you kidding me? I'm like, no, just allow him to give you a verbal report at the end of every week. And that's what they did. But, I mean, it's not like Dexter Manley's the only one.
Right.
It's crazy to think that
can
happen.
It is crazy. You can get through high school and college and push along and read it at a second grade level. I mean, mm-hmm. we're talking about C-spot run is what we're talking about. I mean, incredible kind of stuff. Also born on this date in 1973, Patrick Jeffers, who had that one brief year of glory for fantasy football owners back in 1999.
Virginia guy, wasn't he?
He came out of nowhere. Was he a Virginia guy? I'll tell you in a second.
He
was a Virginia guy. And had 1,182 yards starting 10 games in 1999 for the Carolina Panthers. This date in football history brought to you by Dr. James McCall's Comprehensive and Cosmetic Dentistry on Gate Parkway. If you're in the market for a family dentist or you need cosmetic work done, call 620-9225 or visit jamesjmccall.com for a complete list of comprehensive care services. That is this date in football history.
Now, the Honda Drive around the NFL, brought to you by your Jacksonville area Honda dealers.
Well, the Atlanta Falcons and Seattle defensive coordinator Dan Quinn have reportedly come to terms on a five-year deal that will make Quinn the next head coach of the Falcons. Quinn declined to comment on it last night, saying that in deference to the Super Bowl, that he would wait until a more appropriate time to discuss his own future. Quinn is expected to be in Atlanta today and announce his hiring and contract tomorrow at a press conference. Speaking of the Falcons, they are being investigated for pumping artificial sound into the stadium. Oh, visiting teams are on the field, specifically when opposing teams are in their huddle, for the past two seasons. If the Falcons are found by the league to have done that, the penalties they might be facing could include a forfeiture of draft picks. Peyton Manning is expected to announce this week whether or not he plans to return to the Denver Broncos for another season. All signs point to Manning returning for at least one more year with the Broncos. And Johnny Manziel is entering rehab, or more accurately, has entered rehab. The news broke just a few moments ago, but reportedly he entered rehab last Wednesday. I'm assuming alcohol.
You said, well.
Well, wait a minute. How about the rolled up dollar bill?
Right. I'm not assuming anything.
I think it's
Johnny
a lot of
Manziel,
things.
You know?
I think it's a lot of things with Johnny.
Certainly could be. I think anecdotal evidence is there. You said, Jeff, you didn't think this franchise was ever interested in drafting Johnny Manziel.
I don't think they were going to touch him with a 10-foot pole, but you want to keep people thinking that you have an interest in him because of trade possibilities.
Put it this way, at this point in time, and we've seen careers get off to rough starts to get turned around, but I would think every quarterback needy team that passed on him is thanking their lucky stars.
Well, and think about the position that Mike Pettine and Cleveland Browns are in. I mean, you got a quarterback who you drafted to be the franchise quarterback. You have what is clearly one of the best wide receivers in the National Football League, and both of them have substance abuse problems.
What did you make of that? There was some talk last week, should the NFL be in the business of telling you you can't, you know, partake in illegal activity, which is drinking? To me, whether they should be or not, the rules allow them to. And Josh Gordon knew what he was not allowed to do. The court system will tell you, and I get it, the courts and the NFL are two different things, but the courts can tell you, as a condition of your probation, you can't drink alcohol. You can't, you know, consort with certain people, known felons, for instance, right? You just can't, you know, it's not necessarily illegal, say if your neighbor is a felon, to, you know, have lunch with them, but in certain cases, you're not allowed to do those kind of things. To me, in Josh Gordon, whether he knew that condition or not, it's on him, it's on his team. Well, he should have known it.
Yeah,
if he didn't know it, I would think he would know it too. You know, we had Mike Florio on last week. He said, look, you know, his representatives, his agent, his people need to be, you know, making sure they tell him, well, who's to say they haven't? Josh Gordon knew what the conditions were, whether they were fair or not. And we go through this thing all the time. Players, oh, I hate the franchise tag. Contracts are this way. You know, a team can do this, but a player can't do that. Guess what? You signed the CBA, which allows them to do that.
Well, a lot of players didn't sign the CBA, but let me say this about
the majority
the
of them signed off on it.
It is a right to breathe. It is not a right a natural born right to play in the National Football League. It's a privilege. And as far as I'm concerned, if the NFL has stipulations about requirements of playing in the National Football League to keep the integrity of the game to a certain point, I'm all for it. So the NFL has every right to have strict requirements on their players. They should. Because if you don't have that, and if you don't have protections built in, then you have incidents happen that take away from the game and take away from its popularity.
I like, on a related note, obviously for the time being, Josh Gordon, Justin Blackman, you know, are related stories, right? Because Justin Blackman's not yet back in the good graces of the National Football League. Shad Khan saying last week, you know, that obviously they would welcome him back. They think that that they're optimistic. He's optimistic about his return. I think there's been that growing sense ever since. I believe Mark Long was the first one to report that Justin had entered rehab, and we believe he successfully completed that rehab. He still has to apply, and he still has to apply in a time frame that if it matches up. Dave Caldwell expressed they would like to know by the draft, at least, what the outcome is going to be on Josh Gordon. Now, the commissioner, once he receives his official appeal for reinstatement, has 60 days to rule on that. So he's got to get that move in a somewhat timely fashion to if he's going to help the Jags out, at least to go into the draft knowing where they're going to
You
stand.
Said Josh Gordon, but I know you meant Justin Blackman.
Justin Blackman. If I say Gordon, I'm sorry.
And look, I like Justin Blackman. He hasn't hurt anybody, although he could have, which is concerning. But I like him personally. I think Justin is a good person. He's got issues that he's had to work through, and he's probably going to have to work through them his entire life. But if he is healthy and he can represent the league and the Jacksonville Jaguars in a positive fashion going forward, I'm all for Justin Blackman being able to continue on his career because I like the guy, and I think he's a fantastic football player in those orders. I like the guy, and he's a great football player.
Yeah. I don't know him as well as you do. Everything you've heard, his teammates always liked me. It wasn't an issue. It was more of a self-destructive situation. But ultimately, you know, that has repercussions on your team as well because he's been...
You got to be dependable.
Right. You got to be accountable. Exactly. But despite that, I think the guys you talk to that have played with Justin, and that number is dwindling now. There's been so much turnover on this football team. I've yet to hear anybody on or off the record not, you know, support him, swear by him, what have you, express the same sentiment you're saying, that he's a good guy and he's more hurting himself than he is anything else right now. So like him to put hurting himself in the rear view and helping this football team in the forefront be pretty nice.
He's a fantastic player. I mean, Justin Blackman has unbelievable athleticism, strong hands, top competitor. I mean, he's got everything that you'd want in a football player at that position. I mean, if they can get him back to be able to team him with some of these young guys that they got last year, this could be a wide receiving core that Blake Bortles would be absolutely excited about.
No doubt. 641-1010, if you'd like to weigh in, take a quick time out. We'll come back. More of a Wild West Guns and Gold Monday coming up. Your thoughts on Super Bowl 49 as we put that in the rear view. We'll get to your questions coming in via social media as well. 641-1010 if you'd like to call in. It's Jaguars Today on 1010XL 92.5 FM. Jaguars Today. This is the first Jaguars Today in the history of the month of February, by the way. So you know. Kind of a historic date. Mark this one down, Tony, if I need something for the state in football history next February 2nd. We got one right here. All right. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony, Jeff Loggeman here with you. Jaguars sent out Wild West Guns to Gold Monday. Question or questions from Torrance Black. I got these on Facebook. Could it be conceivable that the decision to pass, obviously on the play that resulted in the interception there for Malcolm Butler, was a business decision? Lynch would have most likely won MVP and would demand more money? Question mark. Imagine the postgame interview if that happened. Now, while I agree it would have made for great theater to have Marshawn Lynch after the week he had of not talking up on the stage, would he have said anything? Would he have said something that made people uncomfortable? What would have happened in that scenario? Would he have said, y'all know why I'm here. here's the MVP. Y'all know why I'm here.
I'm just here so I won't get fined.
That might have been that. You know, you don't know what he would have said. No way in hell do I think that Pete Carroll cares at all about the Seahawks cap situation, the relevance of who's the man? Is it Wilson v. Lynch? You're on the brink, Jeff, of you've won two in college, right? Even though one of them might be questionable these days. You're on the brink of winning two in the NFL and having a unique place in coaching history. There's no way you're thinking of this stuff.
Well, I mean, that requires too much thought. And in a moment like that, you're worried about winning. That's
right.
It. Period. Winning.
Right. Now, the counterpoint would be, well, maybe they thought ahead. If it comes down to a one-play type scenario, no. They made a bad call at the wrong time. Or put it this way, the result was a bad result. You can question 6 seconds left. They throw the fade to Matthews. 6 seconds, maybe you got time to do that and have it still fall incomplete, but there was a risk they were running. That pass falls incomplete and they get no points on the board at the end of the first half,
mm-hmm.
and they go in trailing into halftime instead of at least getting the field goal, which, what was the score at the time? 14-7. Okay, so they tied it up going into the half.
And
right.
By the way, thanks NBC for that entire time. There was a timeout, there was the penalty. They never once told or showed us where Seattle would be running that play from. In like that 2 minute span where you're trying to figure it out in your own head, do they have time to run this play or not? They never told or showed us
what yard line?
Yeah, where they'd be scrimmaging that ball. I had no idea. I was like, just show me where they're going to be so I have an idea in my own head of whether I think they're doing the right thing.
Right. How many seconds will it take to run it to the end zone? I mean, it turned out to be a great play, but if that.
They're an aggressive team. You know, I mean, and that's it. They live and die by the sword.
Your rule of thumb is you got 4 seconds. You know, so I mean, they had plenty of time to make that, and if they chose to kick the field goal with 6 seconds left, I would have been saying shame on Seattle.
Okay, now I can see a scenario though where that ball gets thrown and he's going to the ground and it's being juggled and it falls incomplete and the clock runs out on him. You know, I mean, I don't know. I just think oftentimes we judge the call by the result. And that's fair if you want to do it that way, but I think sometimes the same call, you might like the call to run it with Marshawn Lynch here. Marshawn Lynch coughs it up and fumbles it. Is that the right call? I mean, it didn't work. You know, you could still argue that it's the right call, but
he doesn't fumble.
Well, if he had, I mean, I'm sure he's fumbled. You know, we don't know. Maybe Russell Wilson muffs the exchange. Maybe it's on Wilson. You just don't know. You know.
There's so many different things to talk about this game, but can I make mention of a couple things here?
Do anything you like, Jeff.
The NFL lost a matriarch this over the weekend, Ann Mara.
Yeah.
Passed away. And then also last week, a good friend of mine, Paul Nudell, who was and you probably read his stuff forever. Paul, when I was in New York playing with the Jets, was the longtime beat writer for the Daily News, I believe. And then eventually, got a job with, I think it was the Star Ledger, and he passed away last week after a very long battle, and he is survived by his wife and three boys, and just wanted to mention that because he was one of the great writers that I had the experience of being able to spend some time with.
Duly noted, 641-1010, if you'd like to get on board, Jaguars Today, post-Super Bowl edition, kind of looking back at what happened yesterday, obviously, with the close of the NFL season. Jeff, while we were gone, some additions, some changes to the Jaguar coaching staff. Get your thoughts here on Greg Olsen. Greg Olsen, the timing wasn't all while we were away, but Greg Olsen now, Doug Marrone, and Nathaniel Hackett all being added. And as of right now, Frank Selfo is still on board, although Nathaniel Hackett is going to have the title of quarterback's coach. What do you make of the reshaping of the offensive side of the coaching staff?
Well, I like it, and I think Greg Olsen really was in the running when they hired Jed Fish. And so I like Greg Olsen. I think he's got a great mind. I thought that the offense that Greg Olsen was a part of here for that 1 year with Mike Mularkey as the head coach and Bratkowski as the offensive coordinator, I thought the design of it was fantastic. The execution of it obviously wasn't exceptional, but his passing concepts are very good. And if you look at the numbers that Derek Carr had in Oakland for a young player with a bad team, the numbers as far as protecting the quarterback, the interception to touchdown ratio was very good. I like him personally. I'm glad that he got the job, and I think that Doug Marrone kind of just strengthens that offensive side of the ball because he's got great experience on the offense, and he's got a track record of being a very good offensive line coach. And it kind of presents a little bit of an authority on that side of the ball. the more strengths you can get on the side of the football that the head coach does not have a specialty on, the better that you are. I think those are both good hires. Now, as far as the quarterback's coach, Nathaniel Hackett, I don't know that much about him. But I like that they kept Frank Selfo on staff because Frank Selfo has an excellent record in developing quarterbacks. Now, I don't know what his title will be, but I can't imagine a scenario that Frank Selfo is not involved in some way, shape, or form with also working with the quarterbacks. The more quarterback coaches that you have, the better you are.
Are you?
For a franchise. Absolutely.
Well, I didn't know. I'm asking a serious question. I mean, can there be too many cooks in the kitchen? Does that risk, you know, having competing voices?
It can be if the relationship between Nathaniel Hackett and Frank Selfo is not good.
But they got to have the same vision, right?
They got to have the same vision. They got to be on the same page. But I know Frank Selfo. He's a wonderful guy, a wonderful personality. I can't imagine Frank Selfo and Nathaniel Hackett. The one thing that I've heard about Nathaniel Hackett is that if you think Gus Bradley is full of positive energy, Gus would actually be looked at in somewhat of a negative fashion compared to Nathaniel Hackett. So I think the personalities will mesh.
Well, I look forward to meeting all these guys this week, hopefully, and getting to know them a little bit better and bringing you some their thoughts here on Jaguars today.
I also love the fact that Ron Middleton, the tight ends coach, is staying on staff. He's an excellent coach. He's got also great experience because he played the game at that position, but he's also a nice person to add in the special teams category because Ron coached special teams with the Duke Blue Devils for a while and was one of the great NCAA programs on special teams that there was under Ron Middleton. And then keeping Jerry Sullivan, who is regarded as one of the best, if not the best, wide receivers coach in football.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all good stuff.
No, I'm with you on that. Look, if you are the critic, I think it's easy to understand why you sit there and you say Greg Olsen ran the 32nd ranked defense. You talk about, well, what did he have? Well, the Jags didn't have a lot either, and that got their coordinator fired because he ran the 31st ranked offense. I think I said defense, offense. Mm-hmm. You don't understand what I'm saying. Nathaniel Hackett helped coach a quarterback who, much like Blake, probably could have benefited from some more seasoning and more learning time, observing, working on some mechanics and things like that. And there's E.J. Manuel, their first-round pick from the year before, getting benched after a month in the season. And clearly they didn't get the best out of E.J. Manuel. Or maybe they did. Maybe there's not anything better to get. And that's possible. But they certainly didn't turn what the guy they took in the middle of round one into at what appears to be right now a long-term answer in Buffalo. Yeah. Or if they had, they probably would still be around.
You could also look at the fact that Kyle Orton had one of his most successful seasons as a passer. You know, and say, well, maybe Nathaniel Hackett did a great job of working with Kyle Orton.
Maybe
so. I mean, there's different ways to look at it.
Absolutely. I'm just, you know, food for thought. Certainly there are going to be the people that look at that and say, this is curious.
I think it's interesting, though, is that, you know, all the hot coaching properties all kind of come from success or not. You know, just because there's a coach that comes from a 32nd ranked offense doesn't mean that this coach is not a good football coach.
Sure.
And personnel has so much to do with that. I mean, it's the same thing with Kelly Skipper, the running backs coach that the Jaguars hired from the Oakland Raiders. Well, why couldn't Skipper get anything out of Maurice Jones-Drew and with the other running back?
Darren McFadden.
Darren McFadden.
Maybe there was nothing left to get.
Maybe not.
Right.
You know, so just like all the new head coach of the Atlanta Falcons, the defensive coordinator Dan Quinn, you know, well, is it Dan Quinn or is it the personnel? Well, is it Gus Bradley or is it the personnel
right
in Seattle?
Dan Quinn's defense just gave up 4 touchdown passes yesterday to Tom Brady. I mean, you could go all day on this kind of stuff, round and round and round. So
I like the fact that they took their time, you know, and I talked a little bit with Gus kind of through the process. And I mean, you want to talk about a thorough evaluation and taking your time and making sure that the fit was good, the feel was good. I give Gus credit because he didn't panic. He didn't say, hey, I want to get this guy because he's hot. He really went into depth with these guys. Multiple conversations, brought some of them together to make sure that they had the same vision and that they knew each other in a positive way. I mean, to me, that's all good stuff.
Got this question in. Now, getting back to the Super Bowl a little bit from Jeremy Smith on Twitter. Can we discuss why Belichick wasn't calling timeout with a minute to go, did not understand? I don't know if anybody does, because even if you stop them, okay, you use your timeouts. I guess the worst case scenario there, you call timeout and Seattle preserves some timeouts, although I think they only had the one at that point.
Seattle
right?
had the one. New England had two. The play was run with 1:06.
So the running play, which gained 3 yards down to the one, was
yes.
run with 1:06. So right around 1 minute left. Why wouldn't you call a timeout if you're Belichick? Because either they're going to score and you're going to have very little time left, or they're not going to score and you're going to run the clock out regardless of how much time you're with only one timeout for Seattle. There seemed to be no reason other than to not let Seattle have an extra moment, I guess, to, you know, get their thoughts together. And maybe it worked out that way. Maybe they were a little bit rushed, right, in that scenario. They opted to go with, although they were coming off a timeout when they did that, right? Because.
No, they were. Well, essentially what they did by not calling the timeout, they put themselves in a position where Seattle may have to throw on one of those downs. And instead of handing them the opportunity to run as much as they want, you're going to get the ball. Best case scenario for New England at that point was we're going to get the ball with 20 seconds left. I mean, that's the best that they could do from the situation they were in was get the ball back with 15 or 20 seconds left and hope we have the opportunity from that point if Seattle was going to score. So not calling the timeout, as I thought about it, I was actually okay with it because you kind of force Seattle to make the decision in that case.
I don't think you do because Seattle, well, you force them to make the decision, but if
right.
Seattle decides to go and play immediately and just come up and run, then they're going to have enough. They
then
can
you're
run
calling
three
the timeout
more
anyway.
Times.
Then you're calling your timeout anyway if you're New England or Seattle is, and you're not in any worse a situation if you're New England.
Oh, I think you got to save every second you can if you're the Patriots.
I think New
scenario.
England did it perfectly
because they won.
They won. You know, as far as the decision,
I think that's a cop out. Come
well,
on.
Well, here's the thing: the decision to use a timeout or not to use a timeout. Matt would love to have this conversation with Tony Khan. As far as the statistics, the analytics of using timeouts in that scenario, I don't know if there's anybody better on the planet that could give you an answer in that scenario than Tony Khan.
I just don't know why it wouldn't benefit you to have more potential time because there's no way Seattle's not going to have the ability, if you get the ball back, to call enough timeouts to force you to punt in that scenario. So the only thing you're doing is potentially saving the time for yourself if you need it to drive down the field on the ensuing kickoff, which at that point it looked very likely that they were going to, you know?
You were putting the game on those four downs.
It worked.
By not taking the timeout, you were saying we're going to stop them on these next three plays or we're going to lose the Super
right,
Bowl.
Right, but why not give yourself, okay, we didn't stop them and we still have a chance to win the Super Bowl. I mean, there's no drawback to me to calling the timeout because of that scenario.
Well, I mean, there is in that if you use the timeout, it gives the run pass option.
Well, how does it give it any more than, because Seattle, going into that play, Seattle chose to run the clock down to about 20 seconds, okay? You call the timeout there, they're going to run it with however many seconds are left on there.
But maybe Seattle's thinking changed, would change on that second down play.
Maybe. I think you can't count on, first of all, you don't know what Seattle's going to call. For all you know, they're going to come out there with 20 seconds. They're going to line up in the I formation. They're going to pound Marshawn Lynch in, and now all you've done is waste 40 seconds. That and you're going to get it back with 15 seconds instead of 55. I don't know. I just I think there are a lot more benefits to calling it than there were not, but it worked out. Doesn't mean it was the right call.
No.
Right.
No, but it worked out.
It did work out. Obviously. We understand that cuz the Patriots are hoisting it. Do you consider the Belichick Brady era to be one era? Do you consider it to be a dynastic era, or do you, like some people are responding today, are saying no, they haven't won a Super Bowl in 10 years. This is not a dynasty. Maybe the previous 3 and 4 was a dynasty. This is something different. How do you look at it?
It's the same. It's coach quarterback combination is all about evaluation. And you look at what they've been able to do since Belichick took over with the New England Patriots in 2000. I mean, it's the greatest feat that's ever been accomplished in NFL history because it's combined into an era of free agency, which makes it even more difficult. I mean, when you start talking about the Pittsburgh Steelers and the San Francisco 49ers, you know, the 49ers talk, I think, can make the argument that maybe they're the greater because they did it with two different quarterbacks and Steve Young eventually took over for Joe Montana. But to be able to have consistent success in the free agency era to where the New England Patriots had one season in the Brady Belichick era that was not a non-winning season. And that's the only season that Tom Brady missed when he had a knee injury. is phenomenal.
Oh, they had a winning season that year.
Well, I had a winning season, but as far as
their only non-winning season, I think was 0-2. It was. I think they went 7-9 or 8-8 or something like that.
Like a non-winning season.
I could have sworn they went 9-7 because that was the year I think they won the Super Bowl. Then the next year he came back and he led the league in TD passes and they didn't make the playoffs, but I thought they were still pretty good that year.
I'll check.
Regardless, he led the league, by the way, with 29 touchdown passes. That was, could you imagine? I mean, that'll never happen again, will it?
No.
Unless they drastically roll the rules back. Let's get Paul in here before we break. Paul, you're next up on Jaguars Today. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, fellas.
Good morning.
I just want to say I didn't have a problem with the play call that the Seahawks ran there when Butler got the pick. I had a problem with formation and execution of the play in that they lined up Lynch to the side and then they just ran him straight out. Whereas if they go more of a pistol formation or under center, then the Patriots would have had to have honored Lynch. They didn't really have to honor, and he ran right out into a pattern. He didn't stay in a block. He didn't play action, nothing. So,
well, let me stop you right there. Yeah. With the coverage that the Patriots had, it really didn't matter as far as what the formation was. They were playing man coverage, cover one, and the defensive backs aren't even paying attention to what Marshawn Lynch is doing in the backfield whatsoever. You know, so I don't think the formation or play action from the where they were at would have changed the way the Patriots approached that play whatsoever. Now, if you change the formation, and as far as play action, could it have changed the call by changing your personnel grouping on the field? Possibly. But on that play, the Patriots were playing man up, and defensive backs are not even looking at Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. So the play action had nothing to do with that play.
All right, 6-4-1-10-10 if you want to get in before we wrap up today. Tony, did you find the record for the Pats back then?
9-7.
9-7. So, no losing records, right, in the Brady Belichick era?
Correct.
If the upon a couple of missed playoff seasons.
One playoff missed
season. Right, they missed that year, and they did miss in 2008 when Brady was hurt, but they did win 11 games.
Yeah,
I think they won 11 games with Matt Castle that year, which was a 5-game drop off, obviously from 16-0. But
I read an article that Pro Football Talk put out this morning, and just let me throw a couple of these things out there. Since Brady took over as quarterback in 01, 6 Super Bowls, winning 4. Winning record, 14 consecutive seasons, 16-0, regular season NFL history, the only ones to do that. Conference championship round of the playoffs 9 times, made it to the playoffs 11 of the last 12 years, missing only in the year when Brady was lost for the season in week 1 with a knee injury, and that year they went 11-5. I mean, it's hard to argue that combination is not the greatest in NFL history.
And cheating scandal after cheating. Nah, I'm just kidding. Or am I? 6-4-1-10-10. We'll come back. Fan feedback spotlight. Do you think it's the greatest dynasty in NFL history? Do you even think it's a dynasty? We'll do that next on Jaguars Today on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Russell Wilson tends the hands he has. Wilson, quick throw. And it's good. Intercepted. He intercepted by Malcolm Butler. Butler has it at the one. Malcolm Butler stepped in front of the throw. And the Patriots get a possession with 20 seconds to go in Super Bowl 49 with a 4-point lead over the Seahawks.
It's got to be one of the dumbest calls offensively in Super Bowl history.
That was the Patriot Radio Network broadcast, ESPN Radio in Boston on the call. Malcolm Butler with the interception. I was telling you guys a moment ago, whoever's got the obscure Malcolm on their team next year. Malcolm Smith wins Super Bowl MVP last year after picking off Kaepernick in the end zone when Sherman tipped it away from Crabtree. Goes on to win MVP. And then Malcolm Butler with the play of his life. And, you'd say he's got a long life ahead. I doubt he's making a bigger play than that. I don't care how many years he plays football.
And basically playing in the second half a lot because the other two guys have been abused by Chris Matthews.
You know what, though? Honestly, when Jeremy Lane went out, that changed that game, I thought, a lot.
Really did.
They picked on Thorold Simon the entire rest of the way. And
yeah,
just
I tweeted out,
use that guy.
That second quarter, I was like, please tell me an injury to Simon isn't going to be the, tell me the injury to Lane isn't the difference in this game. As a football fan, I didn't want to see that be the difference.
And here you have Jeremy Lane who running his mouth about Gronkowski, you know, oh, he's not that good and all this stuff. And then he, I don't know if he backed it up, but he made a critical play, certainly at that point. I think you or any of us sitting there could have made that play. As we said, that was on Tom Brady. That wasn't some spectacular play by Jeremy Lane. But I thought it was going to be a leg injury, the way he got hit. But I guess he landed on his arm.
Did you see the photo?
I did not. I don't like to see those.
Photo's bad. The elbow bent completely the wrong way.
God, that's how I broke my arm in college.
When they put you in an air cast, you're not coming back.
Right.
You know, they don't put air casts on because they think you may have something wrong with your arm. That means there's something wrong with your arm.
They're pretty sure that you got
something
wrong.
But, I mean, that wasn't the only injury now. I mean, to lose Cliff Averill, you know, there when New England was able to put together a couple scores down by 10 points and not having Cliff Averill there, one of their best pass rushers, that hurt.
No question about it. There you go, though. They played it out. Patriots win it. Fourth time in the Belichick-Brady era. Six appearances in the Super Bowl. So we asked you today, the Tom Bush Family of Dealerships Fan Feedback Spotlight, is it the greatest dynasty in NFL history? Tony, what kind of response?
Here's what we got from Ocho Fisho. No. Pretty simple. From Brandon, no. Spygate is the black mark that tarnishes it for me. From Paul, yes. From Duval Doom, getting there. But more importantly, can we never compare Peyton to Brady Montana or Unitas again? Hashtag not the greatest.
We can't compare Brady to Peyton Manning?
No. Can we never compare Peyton to Brady, Montana, or Unitas again?
Oh, can we never compare Peyton to those
right.
guys? I got you.
Yes.
All right.
From Kenny, we got Khan Dynasty was pretty amazing, killing an estimated 60 million. Apparently, he's watching Marco Polo.
I'm sorry, was that in NFL history? I wasn't sure. Maybe
we'll,
I just asked in
we'll
history.
We'll see. There's still a Khan Dynasty to come here those in
Ming, those Ming dynasties made some nice vases.
Right. He says he does agree the Pats were the best, though.
All right. On Twitter, Nicholas Wall said, yes, six Super Bowls, four wins, not too bad. Hashtag Jaguars today. Hashtag NE Dynasty. And Matthew Walden follows up with, nope, they hadn't won a title in 10 years, so no dynasty at all. So, hey, you know what? It's that's up to you to interpret however you like it. I like your reasoning, Jeff, that you gave. In this era, it's tougher to do to keep it together year after year.
Well, I mean, way tougher. And Belichick has done it really with not being afraid to part ways with certain guys. I mean, which is amazing. You're talking about, you know, shipping away a safety, shipping away a guard. Many people viewed as, I mean, elite players. And he's just like, hey, we got to move on. We're moving forward.
I hope they keep Darrell Revis because that means less money for Devin McCourty potentially. Right. I mean, at least from that standpoint, all right, we'll see. That's a lot of, thank you, Tyler. That's why I'm setting that up that way. Let's go to Bud with a question about Devin McCourty. Hi, Bud.
Hello, sir. How are you doing today?
We're good. Thank you.
Yesterday, I called before the game started and asked my friend to keep an eye on McCourty, you know, and give me his opinion about him. But he was a no-show, and I was wondering if that was just game plan or what. But I don't believe he made any tackles or was on any play, and I'm just wondering about your opinion about his situation as far as
I didn't notice him yesterday either, but prior to that had a great couple of postseason games.
Well, and he's a safety playing against a team that doesn't have a marquee tight end, does not have a marquee running back coming out of the backfield with the exception of Marshawn Lynch, but they chose to match up the linebackers against Marshawn Lynch. So, I mean, look, I mean, safety sometimes won't show up just because of the matchups that they choose to have. That's just the way it is. Now, did he have a bad game? I don't know. And it's one thing that I always do every year is I watch the Super Bowl on film. And I watched last year's Super Bowl on film, and I look forward to watching this year because you get to see so much more. You get to see exactly what the X's and O's of the game are and what the matchups are. So at some point this week, next week, I'll watch the game and then get a closer look at what Devin McCourty did and didn't do.
Let's get a quick one in with Jim in Ponte Vedra. He's got a question about the Jaguar coaches. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, real quick, on a couple of notes. Jeff likes to brag a lot, but he didn't seem to tell you that Kool-Aid graduated from UVA, too, so we won't go there.
No. Come on now.
Also, on the coaches' hire, I mean, nobody thought Belichick was going to be that great a hire when he came to New England. So, and, you know, everybody criticizing the Olsen hire and everything else. if you ask the average football fan or the even the avid football fans, name, you know, 10 offensive coordinators in the NFL, most of them probably lucky to get 5. You know, it's you don't know these guys until they become famous, and so you got to give it that way. And then one last thing, Jeff, I don't know how you survived in the NFL without losing all your money. After watching some of these Super Bowl, you know, highlight things that they show during Super Bowl week on ESPN of every Super Bowl game, it's amazing everybody didn't lose all their money with fines, because when you compare what the quarterbacks went through then compared to now, it's like, you know, Ted Hendricks taking somebody's head off was no big deal back then, but today you can't even touch the guys. So it's amazing that anybody survived. So you guys have a good one.
All right, thanks.
Thank goodness they changed the rules after I was done playing. Although they were in the process of changing them while I did play. But they didn't take a lot of money out of your pocket. They would just send you warning letters.
Right.
And then I don't think I got one warning letter. I mean, it used to be status quo, interception, find the quarterback, free shot.
Yeah. I will say this as far as the, you know, who thought Belichick was a good hire. I would think, certainly that worked out famously. Okay. I think a lot more of those questionable retread hires end up going the other way than they do the Belichick way. If you want to use that as the example of what can happen, sure, it can happen. Is it the most likely thing to happen?
Well,
typically, no.
Look at the great coaches in the National Football League. You know, every Hall of Fame coach has, for the most part, a Hall of Fame quarterback that has gone in with them. Now, there are exceptions. Joe Gibbs, me and you were talking about during the break.
Three different QBs. Yeah.
You know, but I mean, it's just not very often that you have a Hall of Fame coach that has not had a Hall of Fame quarterback. That's just the way it is. And Bill Belichick was not successful until he got Tom Brady as a quarterback. Now, relating that to the Jaguars, Gus Bradley, will he have great success? We'll find out. A lot of that's going to be due in large part to the performance of Blake Bortles in the future.
No question about it. Jeff is going to end our weekly spots with you, at least for a while, but I'm sure we'll have you pop in from time to time as the occasion warrants it. Where are we going to hear and see you in the weeks and months ahead?
Jaguars Thursday will be on all through the year, and that's Thursday night at 6 o'clock, and then, of course, the outdoor show every Saturday morning right on these airwaves, 7 to 10.
Beautiful. I appreciate you having me on Jaguars Thursday last week. That was fun.
Yeah, enjoy it. Maybe we can get you on the Nimnik Outdoor Show some Saturday morning.
You know what? I had my cousin Kevin was in yesterday, and he's thinking about relocating to Florida, right? And big fisherman, big open water fisherman. I said, do I know some guys that I need to hook you up with?
We got a few guys he can talk with.
Oh, there's no question about it. Jeff, fantastic stuff on behalf of everybody.
We get
tremendous feedback about having you on. So look forward to doing it again in 2015.